We talk to artificial voices all of the time, checking our credit card balance, making an airline reservation, and ordering stuff.
Are you currently a customer?
Yes.
By customer, we mean someone who already receives deliveries of water.
Yes.
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
Ah! So it's a huge relief when a real person finally gets on the line, right? But then there's also Siri, the genie of the iPhone, and other talking devices that are so good it's tough to believe they are computer-generated. Replicating our voices with machines has been a long and hard pursuit for humans. As Pulse reporter Todd Bookman found, the quest goes back way farther than you might expect.
Sometimes living in a palace just isn't enough. Say you're a royal hanging out in the 18th century. You need food, you need wine, you need entertainment. Let's wheel in the Turk. In Central Europe in 1770, the upper crust found much enjoyment watching a machine made out of wood and metal play chess. As simple as that, a mechanical chess player who beat all comers.
It's now pretty well acknowledged that there was a concealed person inside of it, but it was done very ingeniously, so nobody was really able to expose it at the time.
The Turk consisted of two main elements: a wooden dummy draped in robes, donning a turban, and then this second sort of box, kind of like a cabinet, where a real-life chess master would hide. A complicated series of levers allowed him to move the Turk's arm, which moved the chess pieces. Dignitaries across the continent fell for this thing. Over the years, it would checkmate both Napoleon Bonaparte and Ben Franklin. The guy behind the prank was Wolfgang von Kempelen. And to help sell the ruse, he began working on another invention, a speaking machine.
I suspect that one of the reasons for it may have been to simulate speech to be used as part of the chess player, ideally speech that would sound a little bit inhuman, so that it would make the hoax all the more convincing.
This is Patrick Feaster from Indiana University. He's an expert on early talking machines and says Kempelen's speaking device used bellows, like you'd use to stoke a fire. These were the stand-in for lungs, forcing air through a reed, which would vibrate like a voice box.
And so to play this device, which was enclosed inside a box, Kempelen would stick his hands through holes on the outside and then use his arm to manipulate the bellows.
We're hearing sound from a replica made in 2009. And that right there, Mama and Papa, is your 18th century synthetic voice. Kempelen's machine was understandably complicated to use and never made it into the Turk, but it did eventually expand its vocabulary.
So some of the most impressive words that people reported hearing it say were Mississippi, Constantinople, and Schachspieler, although that last one gave him some trouble.
What does that word translate to?
Oh, chess player.
Kempelen would spend decades tinkering and redesigning his speaking machine, and in 1791, he published a book on the mechanisms of human speech. It's possible Joseph Faber read that book.
Faber took this thing one step further than Kempelen had.
Faber was a German inventor who made big leaps in talking machine technology in the 1840s.
He finally managed to simulate all the speech sounds that he could think of. And then he connected the thing to a keyboard.
Faber called his invention the euphonia. He would sit at it like you would a piano, the bellows and levers and strings dancing under his fingers. He also, for some reason, thought it was a good idea to rig a female mask to the euphonia, so these strange sounds would seemingly pour out of her spooky, motionless face.
People at the time consistently remarked on the fact that it sounded very, very monotonous. So something like this: I am a machine. And this was very unsettling for people to hear. Nobody had really heard speech like that before. In fact, our modern notion of what robotic speech sounds like could probably be traced back to that point.
In the spring of 1890, another step forward. Thomas Edison's talking dolls brought real speech into the machine for the first time. But instead of producing sound, it played back recorded sound. The doll stood about 2 feet tall, pretty blue dress, blonde hair, and inside, a tiny phonograph player. Kids, rich kids, by the way, because these were not cheap, they would wind the device and hear a collection of nursery rhymes.
Difficulty, though, was that the machines easily got out of order. They didn't really work all that well. It was really an effort to use the technology for something it wasn't really quite equipped to do yet.
And it wasn't just that the Edison dolls didn't work well. The bigger issue was that when you did wind the figure at the exact right speed, this is what came out. Not exactly soothing.
No, it may be a step above, "Now I lay me down to sleep." But, you know, if it's a matter of which is more likely to give a child nightmares, I think it'd be a toss-up.
The dolls were perhaps a bit ahead of their time. But that was exactly what people were going for at the World's Fair.
The World's Fair, the New York World's Fair, of 1939.
Held in Queens, the theme was Tools for the World of Tomorrow.
And I declare it open to all mankind.
After FDR's christening, more than 44 million people came to see exhibits. Companies went all out to impress the audience. Bell Laboratories tried to trump everyone with their futuristic machine.
Helen, will you have the voters say, "Greetings, everybody"? Now, will you have him repeat that in a high voice? And now, in his best bass.
After centuries of acoustic devices, the voter was the first speaking machine to rely on electronics. It still played like a piano. The operator would use keys to activate filters, which shaped a tone. Voter wasn't an easy thing to manipulate, but it was closer in terms of rhythm and pitch to how humans speak.
It wouldn't give people nightmares in quite the same way. It sounded like a much friendlier robot.
Voter would mark the start of the modern race for better sound generation. Processing power continued to advance, and before long, computers were synthesizing and creating voices. This is an IBM belting out Daisy Bell in 1961. In the decades since, the best talking programs have swung away from computer-generated sound and instead rely on actual human voices.
D-V-J.
The talking software of today start with an actor in a studio. He or she will read out a collection of words and sentences, which then get broken down into the most basic elements of language, called phonemes. In English, there's about 40 of them. Once all the phonemes are isolated, they can then be recombined to form, in theory, any possible word or sentence.
"Well, I won't say anything you tell me to. I do have my limits."
Apple's Siri is arguably today's best and most omnipresent talking machine.
"Thanks for the compliment."
But as good as Siri is at combining phonemes, there's no way that voice could pass for a human one.
"Your radio voice isn't all that good, either."
Deadpan is good for a dig, I guess, but the inability to stress words and vary timing demonstrate just how large the divide remains between the real and the simulated, between us and machines. Patrick Feaster from Indiana University says bridging that gap has motivated inventors for hundreds of years and will likely do so for many more.
So there'll always be two groups of people, I think. One that likes to point to certain things that machines will never, ever, ever be able to do, and to value human beings more because of it. And then people who will look to those precise same things and look at those as the biggest challenges.
Speech is hard to solve. The voice is the thing which remains, for now at least, quintessentially ours. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.